Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 77, Understanding the Enneagram, February 16th, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Initially, we are not aware of how our perception works, what our preferences are, what our fixations are. That is how we automatically fall into who we are and what we choose, and we think, well, that's just me. It becomes obvious that this isn't personal at all. It's an impersonal structure that basically we have from birth on that it's like an emotional skeleton that helps us orient ourselves in life.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Gabriel Hilberg. Gabriel Hilberg, Ph.D., is a San Francisco Bay Area psychotherapist, business consultant, and international workshop leader who relies heavily on the Enneagram personality system in her work with people over the past 24 years. She says her passion is empowering people to go beyond what they think is possible and to take quantum leaps. Her private practice is in Mountain View, California, where she works with individuals and couples. She is the founder of Thought Horizons Incorporated, and she's co-author of the book Einstein's Business, which was released in December 2006. She holds a master's in teaching from the University of Essen, West Germany, a master's in counseling psychology from Santa Clara University in Santa Clara, California, and a Ph.D. in clinical psychology from the Pacific Graduate School of Psychology in Palo Alto, California. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Gabriel Hilberg, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Now, the reason why we're speaking today is I'm very interested in your work, which I know you're trained as a psychotherapist, and
yes.
And you did therapy for a number of years, and I want to explore that. But more recently, your work revolves around a system known as the Enneagram, and so that'll be a large part of our focus. And maybe we should start out by my asking you, what is the Enneagram?
Well, the Enneagram is, the way I look at it, is a great tool to understand how we are internally wired. It creates a map. It's a system that's based on wisdom traditions like the Sufis, the Kabbalah, Buddhism, Christianity. So there are elements that we find in those traditions. And when the Enneagram was basically created in the last 30, 40 years, the way we're using it now, it is based on those traditions, but then it became more specific about the psychology of how we are perceiving the world and how we are relating the world to the world.
Okay. I did a little background research preparing for this, and so, you know, I would guess that most of our listeners have probably maybe never heard of it, so we really need to start as basically as we can. So I gather one of the things that's associated with it is a nine-pointed star or geometric figure, right?
Yes. It's called Enneagram, which is Ennea, is Greek nine,
okay.
And gram is figure. So we have a geometric figure that maps the different personality styles.
Okay. So it's basically, it's a personality typology, if you will.
Correct.
Great. And how did you get exposed to it?
I was one of the early students about 20 years ago when Helen Palmer in Berkeley started the early seminars, and it was on Sunday nights, and I went for 10 weeks each night a different personality was introduced. And the way the Enneagram is taught is basically as an oral tradition. And what that means is that people who have studied their type are sitting on a panel and the interviewer is asking them about their life, their perceptions, their way that they are in the world, the choices they are making. And as the audience is listening, the idea is that you identify with your type over a number of evenings so that you see the differences of the types, but then with one type, you will get that gut feeling reaction, like, I know how to be that. I know how to be in the world like that.
Uh-huh.
And it's a very interesting method, different than, you know, learning something intellectually, because it's a growing awareness of how you are wired. So when I went to my early seminars, I didn't know what my type was, and it went like a light bulb went on for me when I understood what my type is, and I discovered that I'm a 2 with a 3 wing, which is quite typical for therapists, because as a 2, my main tendency will be to take care of others.
Yes. Actually, as I was reading through the list of the 9 types, and we should go through them, but that was one of the ones that kind of lit up for me. I thought, well, maybe I'm a 2 just because of that.
Yes. Well, we can discuss that later. What was interesting for me is that after I understood what my type was, I went and read Helen Palmer's book, The Enneagram in Love and Work. And I must say that reading my own chapter really made me cringe. And I thought, you know, why did she have to put these things in there? Yeah, I know I do them, but, you know, you don't have to write them down in a book where everyone can read them.
Okay.
And so the first time I read my chapter, I took a highlighter and I went through and I highlighted, you know, what I thought applied to me. And then 6 weeks later, I reread my chapter, and this time I took a different color. And I added the things that now I had become aware of. And I read my chapter a number of times, each time with a different highlighter, mm-hmm. and by the end it was a rainbow color.
So you really, as you stuck with the process, you found that more and more was accurate for you.
Yes, and you know, initially we are not aware of how our perception works, what our preferences are, what our fixations are. That is how we automatically fall into who we are and what we choose, and we think, well, that's just me. But then the shocking thing is to read in the chapter all these descriptions, and the idea is that when it's in the chapter described what you might have thought is your personal style, it becomes obvious that this isn't personal at all. It's an impersonal structure that basically we have from birth on, that it's like an emotional skeleton that helps us orient ourselves in life.
That's interesting. I mean, it almost sounds like it could tie into DNA, or, you know, we're learning so much that we come into the world not as a blank slate, but that we are born with certain predispositions, and what you're
yes.
saying would seem to fit well with that.
You know, I have worked in my practice with people who have processed prenatal material, and already the perception in the womb was the perception of the Enneagram type.
Hmm. Interesting.
And now, you know, we don't know for sure if this is projected backwards, but these perceptional styles are so ingrained that even as we learn more and expand more, our fundamental style stays in place.
Yes. Now, you mentioned that you got exposed to this in a 10-week workshop, but I don't want to leave people with the impression that you're a 10-week wonder. I mean, you've actually spent a good portion of your life deepening your study of this. Isn't that the case?
Oh, yes. So the 10 weeks, each evening would be a panel. So you get a sense of how differently people are really living their lives and seeing the world. So that in itself is interesting. But when I work with my clients, I say basically it's going to take you at least a year to even grasp what your internal map is. And you begin to learn more and more about yourself until, you know, you don't have to think about it as a map anymore, but you begin to live and your awareness as your type.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, were you already a therapist at the time that you discovered the Enneagram, or did that come later? Was that motivated by your interest in the Enneagram?
I was already a therapist for at least 8-9 years, and I see myself as a perpetual student, and I love studying, and I love new approaches and methodologies. And when I was exposed to the Enneagram, I noticed my own personal relief that nobody had ever been able to describe how I am functioning and how I'm internally organized as precisely as with the Enneagram. And I've been in therapy for myself for personal growth experiences since about 27 years.
Okay.
And, you know, because many therapists are of my type, they wouldn't know how to confront the blind spot of my type.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would feel, hey, I'm doing pretty good. You know, it's like I'm a great therapist and things are going well. And when I learned about the Enneagram, I could look that and see that my strength was also my weakness.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fascinating to me.
Yes. Just out of curiosity, what kind of therapy were you practicing before you became involved with the Enneagram?
My basic training is in Gestalt, and okay. At that time it was also transactional analysis.
Mm-hmm.
I have training in hypnosis, prenatal psychology, psychodrama, family constellation work. So I had been exposed to a number of different methodologies.
Yes, yes. And then based upon what you were just saying, I gather that the Enneagram, as in other typologies, that it refers you to both strengths and to vulnerabilities.
Correct. And it allows me, well, it gives me a sense of where my own blind spot lies.
Mm-hmm.
As a two, that is around the issue of pride. And that had never occurred to me, that pride was a major stumbling block for me and a major area of unawareness and difficulty. And then looking back, I could see that most times in my life when things had not gone well, it was based on pride being present.
Can you give an example of that? Since I might be a two, I might benefit from your example.
Yes. So as a two, I would think that I can understand everyone. I will be able to reach the heart of the other person easily.
Uh-huh.
That has been a problem in romantic relationships because, and this is typical for twos, as I learned, is that the more difficult the other person was, the more interesting. And the more somebody would say, well, you know, this person doesn't open up to anyone, pride inside would say, you bet I can.
Yes, right.
Right? And, yeah. I mean, that didn't make much for a happy romantic life.
Yes, I could see where that could be a problem.
Right?
Yeah.
And so that this is for twos who don't know their type and those particular interests in that are part of the type, it's typical that twos are drawn to difficult relationships because it's more juicy. And you know, we have more value if we can open up or help the other one open up.
Yeah, yeah. So in other words, one's pride, if there are two, their pride sort of leads them to take on the challenge of a very
exactly
challenging and, relationship.
And I was like 35 years old, and pride had not ever been an issue brought up in any therapy, or it wasn't at all in my awareness that that could be a problem.
Interesting.
It was so automatic.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. So how would you compare the Enneagram typology to some of the other typologies that are out there? For example, there's Jung's typology and the Myers-Briggs test that goes with it, or astrology is another typological uh-huh system. Are there points of crossover, or, you know, how would you compare it to some of those other systems?
Well, I am familiar with the Myers-Briggs. I have used it in business consulting. I prefer the Enneagram because it gives you a greater depth in the description of behaviors. But mainly, it gives you an idea what motivates people intrinsically and what they are drawn to and what language they might use. So the Myers-Briggs gives you a description of how somebody might be functioning, but it's kind of a two-dimensional system compared to the Enneagram.
Okay.
In astrology, for example, you get a highly individualized map of who you are and what aspects are present in you and how you might live out those aspects. But you don't get a cognitive map that helps you create an awareness pattern where you can look at yourself and get to know yourself ongoingly.
Okay. Maybe have we come to the place maybe where we could step through the nine types? We've been referring
yes
to the number two, uh-huh, and people are probably scratching their head feeling like outsiders.
Yes. All right, very good. So let me start with type one.
Good.
And a one might say these particular statements that I'm now expressing as a one. I'm responsible, conscientious, and try to meet my highest internal standards. I gain love and approval by following the rules. I value integrity, effort, and self-reliance. I tend to be highly critical of myself and others. I hate making mistakes and fear others' criticism. I often feel overburdened with responsibility and become angry and resentful. I believe that I'm not good enough and try to fix myself. I constantly compare and judge myself. I want to be right. Now, there's a particular flavor. Now, we all don't like making mistakes, but for the one, it is a driving force in their life and how they move into any situation or perceive a situation from that point of view. Am I right? Am I wrong? Have I done the right thing? Have I lived up to my own standards? And the fear of others' criticism and the extreme self-criticism.
Okay, yeah. One of the things I always struggle with typologies like this is I can see myself in there. I can probably see myself in each of the types.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
So. Now, otherwise, you know, we would not even understand each other at all if we did not have aspects of this.
Uh-huh.
But as we go through the nine different types, you're going to see the focal point. If
yes
you imagine that reality is like a pizza, right, and we cut it into nine different slices, each slice is part of the pizza, but it presents a different angle of looking at life and being in life. And so as a one, this description that I just gave is core to how they are operating from deep inside and what motivates them. So the motivation, I want to be good, I want to be right, I want to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
Have I gotten it right? Should I have done more?
Mm-hmm. Kind of right? A perfectionist.
Yes, mm-hmm. And actually that type is called the perfectionist.
Okay.
Now, contrasting that to the type 2, which is called the giver,
mm-hmm.
The 2 might say, I'm highly sensitive to the feelings and emotional needs of others. I sense what's missing for them, and I want to satisfy their needs. People often tell me, I couldn't have done it without you. I feel loved when people need me. I easily connect with people in the world. I tend to forget about my own problems and needs and have difficulties articulating them. It hurts when my good intentions are seen as manipulations. At times, I get depressed and feel helpless when I have to take care of everything myself in my own life.
Okay.
A different flavor
mm-hmm.
of being in life.
Mm-hmm. And go ahead.
What you saw with the 1 was a more self-focused position.
Okay.
And here with the 2, it's an overly other-focused position.
Ah, yes.
Okay.
Is there a kind of a 1 or 2 word handle for this to help us remember the 2? You said the 1.
Say that again. 1.
A 1 or 2 word handle. You know, like perfectionists for the 1. How would you?
A giver.
A giver. Okay.
Yes.
So 2 is
now
a giver.
The 3 is the achiever or the performer. And the 3 says, I am valued for my achievements and productivity. My feelings are suspended while I get my job done. I project professional and personal success. I am what I do. I am in a constant state of striving. I deny any feelings of helplessness and powerlessness. I'm the doer. I'll make it happen. So this is the performer.
Mm-hmm.
And the performer believes that I will be loved because of my success. And so the performer looks at life, and performers are always very successful. You already see them in high school, you know, excelling
right.
and being the class president, and on it goes, because they have a knack to intuitively size up where they can be successful, and they gravitate to those areas. Because success, as they believe, becomes a way of being loved and being accepted.
I'm thinking of Donald Trump.
Yes. That could be a 3. Now, you know, what's difficult is when we see behavior of people like Donald Trump.
Yeah.
We don't really know what he's thinking and what motivates him. Is he motivated by success, or is he motivated by expansion of, you know, being great, and is he motivated by greed? We don't know that just by looking at the behavior.
Okay.
And here is the great thing, that when a person understands what your own type is, then you can speak and explain to others what motivates you and how you engage in life.
Okay, good.
So here's the 4. The 4 is called the romantic. And the 4 would be saying, I am a creative, unique individual. I have experienced many painful losses, which have left me feeling rejected and abandoned. I feel that there is something wrong with me. I envy people who are happy in life. I have great emotional depth, and my introspection serves me in my creative expressions. I long for a romantic relationship and the deep soul connection with my beloved.
Mm-hmm.
I value authenticity and sincerity. So here is the type that you typically find with artists, people that are very creative, writers, musicians, who use their emotional depth to project out a creative expression.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get the emotional flavor of it, again, here it's a more self-focused type. And emotions are highly valued. And when we come to the thinking types, you get a whole different sense of how thinking types are in the world versus the emotional type, particularly type 4. So that was the romantic.
Okay. I certainly resonated to parts of that one.
Yes.
I have to tag that as one of my possibles.
Very good. You're on the right track.
Okay.
The type 5 is called the observer. This is the person who will say very little and have a lot of mental process going on inside. So the 5 might say, I am an isolated individual with boundaries that separate me from everything. People are demanding, unpredictable, and intrusive. I easily feel overloaded by emotional input and need my privacy to restore my energy. I have strong feelings of social inadequacy and emptiness. My detachment gives me a keen sense of observation and objective analysis. I'm self-sufficient, thoughtful, and I keep confidences. So here we have the first thinking type.
Yes.
Right? And you find often inventors or financial people gravitate, mathematicians, people who use their keen sense of observation to understand the world, but they almost have like a hermit type personality to them. Type 6 would be, hold on one second. Type 6 is called the loyalist, and this is the person that might say something like this. The world is threatening and dangerous. You just cannot trust people or rely on them. I question people's motivation and intentions. My mind is vigilant, and I run worst-case scenarios. I either obey authority, rebel against it, or question them. I get stuck in self-doubt. I don't really trust myself. Life is a struggle to survive. Human nature is inherently selfish, self-centered, and self-seeking. These are the kind of people who will see everything from both sides. Often they are attorneys or scientists looking at what is the truth, what is underneath, what motivates people, what is really at the core of things.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to know the truth because the truth is safe, while they perceive the rest of the world as looking of difficulties and dangers. Particularly their attention goes to the incongruency in people, and they question people and inquire, you know, what are you really thinking and what's behind your friendliness?
Mm-hmm.
Type 7 would be called the epicure, and the epicure says, I like pleasurable, fascinating ideas, projects, and events. I believe it is better to be happy, excited, and entertained by life rather than dwelling in dark places. I'm interested in many different subjects and drawn to the interconnectedness of it all. I dislike interpersonal struggles, people's negativity, and any limiting beliefs. I like thinking about different possibilities and prefer to leave things open rather than getting locked into commitments and schedules. How does that sound?
Yeah, that certainly, I've got elements of that.
Yes, yes. So let's go through the other next two, and then I know that you are wanting to know where you might be finding yourself in this typology, right?
Of course.
Yes, great. So the 8 is called the boss. The boss might say something like, I like to take charge, and I rely on my own instincts. I put things on the table and confront people if needed. You are either friend or enemy. I hate it when people hint at things. I want you to stand up for yourself and defend yourself. I'm living life full out. Don't get tired, and I have a high pain threshold.
Mm-hmm.
I want your respect, and I demand fairness. If you are being attacked or unfairly treated, I'll step in and set the record straight. I refuse to be controlled by people or life. Here, you have a strong doing element, right? Somebody who takes charge, but often takes charge by being domineering and overpowering others, if not careful.
Okay.
And the nine is called the mediator. And the mediator might say, people say that I'm accepting, caring, and peaceful. I tend to avoid confrontations and conflict. I end up making commitments I didn't really want to make. I get passive, sometimes passive-aggressive, stubborn, or resistant when pushed around too much. I don't like it when others make too many demands and want my attention and energy. I try to please people, and I get caught up in their agendas. I'm easygoing, supportive, and loving.
Oh, I've got a lot of that in me. The nine, the peacemaker, mediator is a role that I've played a lot.
Oh, okay, great. So you see yourself in a number of them.
I do.
And you mentioned that you see yourself in the two, in the nine, and in the seven.
Yes. And probably, you know, well, as you pointed out, I see some of myself probably in each of them. But
absolutely, mm-hmm. Yes. We have ways of being like all those nine different types, but we have a certain preference, and the preference is automatic.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was sitting with the question, you know, who is Dave, who I'm going to be talking to in this interview, you know, I wanted to learn a little bit about you, so I listened to the astrology reading that you got, and I listened to your...
You mean the tarot reading, yeah.
I'm sorry, yes, the tarot reading,
mm-hmm.
And I listened to the interview you did with another station, and to find out, you know, how are you organizing your experiences?
Yes.
And the theme of being excited about new things, about different interests. I looked at your sports activities that you listed on your website.
Right.
And I knew already that you weren't certain types because
mm-hmm.
nobody of the other types would have such a range of physical activity as you have listed. Some I couldn't even pronounce, and I'd never heard of.
Yeah.
So that was a clue that you would be drawn to new and exciting ideas and activities like hang gliding,
mm-hmm.
airplane jumping, was that?
There was skydiving and soaring, which is flying an airplane without a motor, glider.
Yes. Okay. So here, one interesting thing is that many sevens are drawn to the air. You find a lot of sevens in aviation
mm-hmm.
because there's a certain sense of freedom, of being in the air and having a perspective and seeing things from a different position.
Yes, if I had more money, I would definitely have a pilot's license and I would have
yes.
a plane. I mean, no question.
Yes, so I was thinking that. And then I thought, you know, why would Dave go into this podcast and what could be the interest? And I looked at your fascinating list of interviews you have done, and I thought, I bet he's fascinated about learning about so many different things and being able to ask questions and investigate and have something new each time.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be part of why you're doing the podcast?
I think that's definitely part of it. Another part of it is the sense of The sense of maybe it relates to the mediator and to the helper parts of wanting to kind of be a facilitator, to do it as a service to my audience out there, to expose mm-hmm. them to new ideas, and then to facilitate my guests, you know, because I feel like I'm serving them, I'm helping them to get their ideas out.
Yes. So here is something interesting happening. When somebody has done a lot of inner work, it is harder to observe for me as an outsider what your type would be.
Hmm.
Because it's almost like, you know, like a diamond. You have been polished in many, many different ways. A good way of understanding what a type might be in the other person is to ask, you know, what were you like in your early 20s? When personality was in full swing and you hadn't done yet your inner work, what were you like then?
Well, I was definitely, romantic. Relations with the opposite sex were extremely important and a very powerful focus for me, mm-hmm. as was adventure seeking. Feeling a bit of an outsider, being a bit alienated, identifying with people like beatniks and hippies and mm-hmm. things like that.
Were you interested in philosophy, psychology at that time?
Yes, I think I was. I actually ended up minoring in philosophy. My major was creative writing, so there was definitely that pull towards the arts.
Yes, so here, one way of looking at the Enneagram is that it consists of closed triangles. For the seven, it would go to four, which is the artist, and also over to one. And when I listen to the tarot reading, particularly the segment when you did your own show on your reaction to your tarot reading,
mm-hmm.
there was a lot of responsibility that I heard as an underlying theme of wanting to make sure that people understood about projection and how to work with these tools.
Yes.
And the theme I heard was, let's make sure we are doing this right.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes as a one, there is a lot of service also. The one and the two distinguish themselves by the one will pitch in and do hands-on helping, while as a two, I prefer more helping other people process their feelings. So, but again, like I said, it's very difficult when somebody has done a lot of work and basically has been polishing, you know, some of the early ego structures that were much more crudely standing out early on in life.
Yes.
So my working hypothesis would be with you that I would think most likely that you are a seven because of your interests and the way that you are looking at the world and being fascinated by new ideas. Now, if you were a seven, what is automatically built in would be a fear of getting trapped by any kind of arrangement, that would be trapped in a romantic relationship or trapped by an organization or trapped by, you know, having to do weekly podcasts. So because the sevens are about exploring freedom and being spontaneous and being in the moment, and any kind of sort of commitment registers for a seven, like this might bog me down or limit my free choices. Does that ring any bell?
Oh, definitely. I can definitely relate to that. I'm wondering, though, if it can change over time. So, for example, you know, being at this stage of life and having now raised four children, where my first response was, oh, my God, now I'm trapped. You know, I'm trapped by having uh-huh. children and so on. At this point, I rejoice in the fact that I had children, and I'm also less likely to have that trapped feeling.
Excellent. So one of the learning points for a seven is to understand that going deeply into an experience is where the portals open and the richness of life is experienced. Some sevens never learn that lesson. So you find them at age 60 still sort of, you know, being drawn to the latest gadgets, the novel ideas, the adventures. And it's, you know, at that point then other people perceive a seven as shallow.
Yes.
But if you have learned that through commitment do you gain the richness and the depth of life, then commitment does not remain this kind of boogie, fearful thing that it registers for a young seven.
Yes, that's definitely something I've been working on. One of the key words for me as I was doing a little background reading, and I noticed that one of the terms they use in relation to the seven is the Jungian idea of the puer eternus, the eternal child,
yes,
or the eternal young man. And that, I definitely have had a strong thread of that in my life, and also coming from the Jungian perspective, realized that the challenge would be to convert from that archetype to sort of its opposite, which is the sort of the wise old man. And so I've seen that as my challenge, to go from the
very good,
this
yes,
dilettantish young man. I've my worst judgment against myself has been to see myself as a dilettante, not getting deeply enough into things.
Yes.
Which has both, you know, advantages and disadvantages.
So here, now, as I'm listening to you, I'm hearing more and more seven themes. Like, mm-hmm, one of the universal fears of sevens is the fear that one doesn't really know a lot in depth about anything. It's more about the synchronicity between things, the relationship between things,
mm-hmm,
that is the attention point of the sevens. So many sevens have been, for example, architects, inventors, and they have been able to think and put things together in ways nobody ever has dared before to think it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So the high point of a seven is creativity.
Interesting.
Which is great.
Yeah, interesting. I tend not to see myself in terms of a lot of creativity, but other people have described me as being very creative.
Excellent. So one of the things that, as I was listening to the different podcasts that are on your website, the theme of responsibility and the effort that you put into things became quite clear to me. When I was thinking that, oh my God, he's most likely a seven, and he has to take out all the ums and the pauses, that is torture for a seven. And I loved hearing that, you know, you were asking somebody to please, you know, help out and help with the cutting, because as a seven, this is really an activity that will not serve your type and your wiring.
Hmm.
And if you make yourself do that, you go to point one, which is, you know, kind of obsessive compulsive,
yes,
getting it right. And,
yes,
and that is a much denser way for you to be than in seven, when you're interviewing people and you're, you know, dancing with people in the conversation and creating conversation. That's a great creativity.
You're so right. I love it.
Yeah.
I love it because I get so compulsive once when I switch into that mode, you know, that editing mode. Then I actually had somebody help me edit a recent show. Somebody stepped
great
forward as a volunteer. He spent a wonderful fellow in Mexico City, who I want to acknowledge, Fernando, and he spent 4 hours editing, and he sent it back to me, editing out uhs and ums, and I ended up spending another 2 hours.
Wow.
I found 80 more that he had missed after he had been working on it for 4 hours. And, you know, it was probably fine the way that he had it, but I was so obsessive about it that I had to remove every single one.
Right. So here, it would be interesting when you read more of the seven chapters that you find with different authors, and every author describes it from a slightly different angle and with different words, so some authors will resonate more with you than others, that if you could stay and see that your talent is being in the moment and creating conversations with people in the moment, that is what you're really bringing to your podcast.
Okay.
And that, you know, the one part, the responsibility and the being the university professor is sort of like a backdrop that creates, you know, a beautiful, responsible container for these conversations.
Mm-hmm. Well put. Yeah, very well put. So I take it that you don't see the types changing over time. Well, maybe in the sense of becoming more refined, but not changing from a 7 to a 4 or, you know, some kind of major shift like that.
Well, yes and no.
Okay. There,
first of all, each type can be lived out at the unhealthy level, which makes each type really a pain in the butt to be with. At the average level, we call people our friends. And at the evolved level, every type has a beautiful contribution to bring to society and a facet of life that we all benefit from. So each type at the unevolved level is quite unpleasant. At the highly evolved level, getting more and more refined, stepping out of the automatic thought process and making greater choices about how one wants to be, you see, then it fans out more and the person becomes richer in his or her whole expression.
Yes, that's really a theme of it's a much larger theme in the whole study of consciousness that cuts across various spiritual and psychological systems, isn't
Correct.
It? The idea of becoming more and more conscious of one's both one's strengths and one's weaknesses so that one isn't as trapped by them, has more flexibility, more room in which to move.
Exactly. So here I want to go back to a point that we earlier started out making. The Enneagram is a universal system describing universal structures. And the interesting thing is that cross-culturally, the Enneagram is accurate. So if you go to Sweden and you see somebody there who is a 7, and you find a way of communicating, you will have similar interests. That person most likely will also love aviation, is interested in psychology and philosophy, and energetically, you would have a great time with that person.
What about marital and romantic relationships then? Should you hook up with somebody who's of the same type, or is there some sense of the ideal mate for a given type?
Yeah, so here, this is always a question that people, you know, immediately start asking when they learn about the Enneagram. So, in general, people of the same type don't marry. They might date for a while, but ultimately it gets very boring to be constantly looking at your own mirror.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't enough opposite or dynamic tension because you're so familiar with how the other one is that initially that might be pleasing, but it typically doesn't last.
Okay.
So then when you look at the symbol of the nine-pointed star of the Enneagram, you see that some types have a line that connects them, and some types don't have a line at all. Like, the 7 is not related to 3 and not related to 9. And so if you were dating somebody who is a 3, you would, after a while, have to mentally make allowance for that person coming from a different place that isn't very familiar to you. Now, that can be done, but it's not as easy flowing as if you would be with a 4 or with a 1, possibly with an 8, which is a neighbor, or a 6, which is also a neighbor. Okay. So those would be easier relationships. But, you know, if that person is unevolved, even, you know, if it's a related type, you wouldn't be very happy with it. So there are many factors that, you know, we have to observe as part of a good relationship.
Okay. Well, we're coming near the end of our time, and I know that you co-authored a book in 2006, and I want to give you a chance to tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. It's an anthology called Einstein's Business, Engaging the Soul, Creativity, and Imagination in the Workplace. And I wrote a chapter in there called Creative Solutions Under Pressure, which is a process based on my old Gestalt training, where when I work with people, for example, in business or in my private practice, when people are really stuck and having a problem, sleepless nights, and they have really tried everything that has worked for them in the past, but it hasn't solved the problem, then I take them across the room into the future where that problem no longer exists.
Mm-hmm.
And I stand with them in the future until they begin to relax. And even the idea that the problem could be totally gone is such a relief that people step out of their anxiety and their tension.
Yes.
And then I look back with them at the old person sitting in the chair who has still the problem. And we have a conversation about what it's like to have a problem like that, what's the benefit, what they don't have to address by having this problem. And when they see themselves sitting in the problem from a place where they're relaxed and we're playfully talking about how life is better, suddenly they see their own grasping and trying to control the outcome or the solution. And what I have experienced is that when people stand with me in the future, they boldly confront themselves, like saying, well, you know, if you sound so arrogant to the investors, why do you think they want to give you money? And it spontaneously arises in them that they see their own answer. And the principle is the same as when we stand in the shower and we are not thinking that then suddenly we get a whole solution as a picture that has this multidimensional and comes in like a lightning bolt.
Yes, that always happens to me in the shower. Get all my best ideas in the shower.
Exactly. So what I did is look at what happens in the shower, what are the conditions, and I replicate them in my office, in a person's business office, where the condition is that we are not thinking, but we are letting intuition rise. And what I'm thrilled about is that when people see that intuition comes in, it's a sense of a universal intelligence that isn't their own personal IQ that is producing the solution.
Wonderful.
But it requires, go ahead.
Oh, I just said wonderful.
Yes, it requires for people to drop their ego and really step into that open space and to experience that there is a higher intelligence that we can tap into if we are not demanding that the solution should be coming from me and my own thinking and my own past and what I have learned.
I think that's a wonderful close here. I'm going to put a link to your website so that people in the area can find out about workshops that you do and find out some other resources that you have there. And I want to thank you so much for such a delightful conversation.
Oh, very good. Thanks again, Dave, for inviting me. And this was delightful to be playing with you and exploring things.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Gabriel Hilberg. I know that I did. It was very interesting to me to explore this typology that I've heard a lot about. I have had friends who've been very fascinated with it and very involved with it, and I really didn't know much about it myself. And I've always been somewhat leery of typologies in the past, even as much involved with Jung as I have been. It's Jung's typology is the part of his theory that I always related least to. And I think probably it probably has something to do with my type. I'm probably the type that doesn't relate to typologies very well. I think people who are a thinking type probably would be most interested in theoretical constructs like that. That's probably a simplification. I know that many people really find that part of the Jungian approach to be very valuable. In fact, it grew out of Jung's attempt to understand his falling out with Freud. As a result of developing his theory of typology, that he came to understand that Jung and Freud were of two different types. And that was a way to understand the conflict and to understand why, in some ways, that conflict looked like it couldn't be bridged, perhaps. And it's interesting that the Myers-Briggs, which grew out of Jung's typology, the Myers-Briggs inventory, is widely used in business. And one of the advantages of it is that it helps people both to understand where their own strengths lie and to work from those strengths, as well as to understand where their vulnerabilities are. But it also helps people to be less blaming of others and to realize, okay, this person is a different type than I am, and so they don't see the world the same way that I see it, and they don't think in the same way that I think. And as the theory goes, the better that you understand these types, then the better that you're able to fit in with and accommodate other people of other types when you understand how those other types function. One of the other things, of course, that's put me off about typologies in general is whenever I've looked into them, I had that difficulty of seeing myself in each of the different types. And so it felt kind of arbitrary to figure out, okay, which type am I? And sometimes it seemed like the generalizations that come out of these theories seem so broad that, you know, again, that you could kind of see anything in it that you wanted to see. Having said all that, I found Gabriel's presentation easy to relate to, engaging, and credible, particularly with the amount of work that she's put into it. And I saw that, you know, one can go into it in a great deal of depth, and that as you do, your understanding of the implications of the system become more refined and more profound. So it sounds like over time and with work, there can be a lot of specificity. The idea of my being primarily a number 7 does seem to fit. When I first read through the various types, I had a little trouble settling on which one might fit me best. But as she went through the list, I think that was the one where I felt the strongest tingle. And then we spoke a bit offline after the interview was over. And she said something along the lines of that I'm a number 7 if ever there was one. Now, if you're interested in finding out more about the Enneagram, you might want to take a look at the Wikipedia at www.wikipedia.com. That's the online open source encyclopedia. A whole lot of people contribute to it, and you always have to keep that in mind, that it may not be totally accurate when you go there. But by and large, I find it to be a good source. I've gotten a lot of good information from there. If you don't know it, it's spelled WIKIPEDIA.com. It's a wonderful resource. And just look up Enneagram there, Enneagram, and you'll see a lot about the history and so on. One of the things that I learned there is that the system has its roots in the work of Gurdjieff, for those of you who are familiar with that name. And there's a nice succinct summary of the 9 types there, plus links to research on the Enneagram as well as criticisms of the approach. In addition, after our call, Gabriel gave me some additional resources, and I think that you might be interested in them. First of all, there was the book that she mentioned early on called The Enneagram in Love and Work by Helen Palmer, and she said that's a good introduction. She said if I really wanted to go deeper into my type and understand all of the challenges that are attached to it, She recommended a book by Don Riso, R-I-S-O. The main title is The Wisdom of the Enneagram. And she also referred me to two websites, www.enneagramworldwide.com and www.enneagraminstitute.com. And I'll put links to all of those on the website. And if you're interested in more, then just follow the breadcrumbs.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
Support for this show is provided by our sponsors, Podshow and GoDaddy. You'll find great GoDaddy discounts for all your domain name and web hosting needs on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com. If you haven't filled it out yet, you'll find our listener survey there at shrinkwrapradio.com/survey.htm, or there's a link at the Shrink Wrap Radio website. And if you include your name and email address, you'll get a little surprise back from me. Now, I'm afraid there are no new additions to our Frapper map this week. So if you haven't done so, there's a place on the Shrink Wrap Radio website where you can add yourself to our Frapper map. I want to let you know that the first episode of my new podcast series on mentalhelp.net is available. The show is called Wise Counsel, and the first episode is with Dr. John Drimmer, who I had interviewed previously for Shrink Wrap Radio. Same guest, same topic, but a different interview. You can check it out at http://wisecounsel.mentalhelp.net. And there's a link to it at the bottom of the Shrink Wrap Radio homepage. I've had no feedback as of yet on the new Shrink Wrap theme music at the beginning and end of the show. This music is taken from some sent to me by listener Nir Ben Zion in New York City. Please let me know what you think of it. Now let's take a quick dip into our mailbag. The first is from Jeff in Australia, who writes, "Hi, Dave. I'm new to this podcast thing, and yours are some of the first podcasts I've listened to. Thanks so much for your work. I'm a rural psychologist and rely on the internet for much of my information. I also spend much time on the road traveling between schools, so your podcast will provide me with many hours of wonderful listening and professional development. Just wondering if you could contact Dr. William Glasser to see if he would do an interview with you. If you're not familiar with his work, I think you will love it. Keep up the great work. Thanks, Jeff." Well, Jeff, it's always great to hear from a professional. And, of course, I do recognize the name of Dr. William Glasser. He was quite famous, I think, in the 70s for his book Reality Therapy, which everybody in the field, I think, read. And I gather that he's gone on to do other work since then. And, as a matter of fact, I took you up on your suggestion, and I have contacted him, and he's very interested in being a guest. And this just reminds me that I need to actually contact his secretary again to set up an actual appointment time. So stay tuned, and that should be coming up before too long. And now we hear from Jason, who writes, "Dr. Dave, I wanted to let you know I thoroughly enjoy the show. How informative, innovative, and entertaining I find it to be. I am currently an undergraduate at Arizona State University in the Applied Psychology program. I've only been interested in psychology for a year, but after 8 successful years in the military and several major changes, I know that this is what I want to do in life. That leads me to a suggestion for a show topic. I recently discovered the APA Division of Military Psychology, Division 19. Perhaps you could interview a couple of military members on the therapeutic and the research ends of the spectrum. I think it would be interesting to see how the clinicians deal with military members and also what kind of applied research is being conducted. Please, please, please consider this for a topic. Thank you and keep up the inspiring work. Sincerely, Jason L." Well, Jason, that's a great suggestion. I've made note of it. I haven't gotten around to it yet. I have so many good suggestions here, but I really am listening to the ideas that listeners submit, and eventually I'm working my way around to most of them. And finally, one more from longtime listener Lloyd in Australia, who says, "Yellow, halfway through episode number 73, Reflections on the Tarot Card Reading. Love the new style, very relaxed, similar to an audio blog. Just wanted to address your pontificating on the tarot cards, on whether the tarot cards you got were by chance or by design. In my humble opinion, there really is no such thing as chance. They initially come in an order that was deliberate by the manufacturer of the deck. They have then been subjected to thousands of shuffles, but each one was divined by the processes of physics and thus was reordered by a set of rules. Also at play was the decision of how to shuffle made by the shuffler, which would have been affected by numerous factors, such as how they learned to shuffle, what felt right to do at the time, and so on. So the final order that led you to getting your cards was a result of billions of interplaying factors that are impossible to track or predict, but not chance." Okay, Lloyd, I get your point. The laws of physics were in operation there. He says, "You got your cards because the universe unfolded in that way. The question really is, did it do that for a meaningful reason?" Right, that is the question. "Well, I have based my life on the fact that it did, and it's been working so far. If it didn't, then I'm just a very, very lucky person. But the successful people I see around me also rely on the meaningfulness of the universe and its messages. So in my estimation, that's a pretty good proof. Not sure if anybody has taken you up on your editing proposal, but I would be happy to do it if so needed. Best regards, Lloyd." Lloyd, thanks so much for offering to step forward on the editing. I've had two other people step forward. I'll put you in the queue as I wear them out, and then I can perhaps draw on you for your help in that regard. And I thought it was an interesting point that you made about successful people tending to operate as if we, in fact, are in a meaningful universe, and to look to, the synchronicities and things that happen in their lives as meaningful and as perhaps pointing to the next steps on the roads to success. And I've read many accounts of very successful executives who, in fact, do run their lives in just that way. So I really appreciated hearing that point that you made. So I think that better wrap it up for today. As usual, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. I love them. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod. And alternatively, you're encouraged to leave voice messages on MyChingo. And there's a kind of a MyChingo logo there that if you click on it, that will allow you to leave a message. And then in the U.S., you can leave a voicemail on our phone at 206-888-2746. Now, I had just resolved to stop giving out that phone number because nobody ever uses it. And so this was going to be the day that I was not going to give that number out. And guess what happened?
"Hi, Dr. Dave. My name is Susan. I just wanted to let you know that I enjoy getting on the internet and hearing some of your shows that you broadcast. I am a social worker in the Fort Lauderdale area for Mental Health Agency, and I enjoy listening to some of the programs on my free time when I'm at home. And thanks so much. It's great. Love it, love it, love it. And hope you're having a great day. Take care. Bye-bye."
And as if I needed another hint from the universe.
"Hey, Dr. Dave. Big fan of yours. My name's Randy Clare. I'm a doctor of oriental medicine and hypnotherapy here in Seattle. And I noticed you've got a 206 area code, and I'm wondering if you're here in Seattle. Anyways, you know, I found out about you when I got my Macintosh about 4 or 5 months ago, and I've been listening to all your shows. In fact, I've listened to everything on your site. I think you're just doing great. I think you're awesome. And if you are here in Seattle, I would love to gift you a really nice Japanese/shiatsu treatment and acupuncture treatment on the house. So if you are in Seattle, give me a call, 206-706-4511. I've been practicing for about 26 years, and I also practice hypnotherapy. I study with Stephen Gilligan, and I practice NLP. So anyways, I'd love to hear from you, Doc. Hope you're well, and keep up the good work, man. It's just awesome. Bye-bye.
Susan and Randy, thanks so much for leaving those phone messages. How's that for synchronicity? And they both came on Valentine's Day. I do feel loved. And Randy, I hope to get up to Seattle sometime so I can take you up on your generous offer. I'm not in Seattle. I'm just north of San Francisco. But I have a 206 area code for that message phone because of a free service offered by a Seattle-based company called K7, which you can find at k7.net. The only hitch is that if the number isn't used in 30 days, it goes away. So, good listeners, feel free to follow the example of Susan and Randy and leave your messages at 206-888-2746. If you didn't catch that, it's also on the website. Thanks again to Dr. Gabriel Hilberg for the interview. Our next show will be about understanding and improving memory with psychologist and author Dr. Thomas Crook. It should be a good one. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.